Today is November 13th, 1978, and it is about 7:30 p.m. I'm sitting alone here at 1411 Laird Circle, and I thought I might record a few of the incidents of my life. My name is Clarence Orem Kelch, spelled K-E-L-S-C-H, and I was born May 15th, 1915, in Orem, Utah. Orem, Utah is about 35 to 40 miles south of Salt Lake City. It was a farming community when I lived there, and my father was the blacksmith, and I remember as a child watching him shoe the horses and put new metal rims on the metal tires on the wagons and on the buggies. On the buggies they were bolted, and on the wagons they were put on by heating up the metal until it was exceptionally hot, which caused it to expand, and then it was dropped over the wooden wheels and pounded down quickly, and then cold water poured over it so that it would shrink as it cooled off and make a tight fit upon the wagon wheels. I remember as a child going in the shop, and we used to like to try and find nails, and we would grind them down and take them on the anvil and make different little things with them, like little screwdrivers or anything we could find that we could do. Kind of a shop was a fun place to do things. And I guess my father always had tools, so it was kind of the thing that got me interested in doing a little bit of building and handiwork and that around the place. And throughout the years, I've learned to do many different things on my own. My mother's name was Dora Peterson, spelled P-E-D-E-R-S-C-N, and my father's name was John Peter Kelch. My mother was born in Skanderborg, Denmark, and she came to the United States when she was about 6 months old. She met my father in Eureka, which is a mining community in Utah. And my father, when he had emigrated here, had went to work in the Tinnick Standard silver mine there as a blacksmith. And it was here that they raised five of the children, and then later on my father felt that the mining area wasn't the best place to raise a family in the mining town, so he moved to Orem and set up the blacksmith shop there, planning on getting the business from the farmers, such as shoeing their horses and repairing their wagons and a variety of things that they did in the blacksmith shop. I was born there, I guess sometime shortly after they had moved there. And then my grandfather Peterson also moved to Orem, and they lived across the street. And I remember as a boy, we used to go over and visit my grandparents. It was always seemed to be nice as children to have your grandparents live across the street. My grandmother on my father's side lived a little farther south in Orem, about 3 miles south, a couple of miles east up by the Provo River, and she had remarried because my grandfather Kelch had died, and she married a gentleman by the name of Szymanski. But we used to go there quite often and visit. And my Aunt Rose lived there with my father's sister, lived there with my grandmother, and she had two boys. One of them was Leroy, which was about my age, and the other boy was my age of my brother Randall. I come from a family of seven children. My oldest sister, the oldest of the children, was named Vera, and she married a gentleman by the name of Gus Capsis. My other sister, next down, was named Doretta, and she married Albert Beebe at Circleville, Utah. The next was my oldest brother, which was John Kelch, Jr. We always called him Jack. And following him was, well, my brother Jack married Lucille Hales of Spanish Fork. And next in line was my sister, Virginia. And she had had a couple marriages. I forgot the last one that she was married to. And next in line was my brother Randall, who married Dorothy Searle, S-E-A-R-L-E, I think it was. He is a shoemaker and repairs shoes, following the trade of my grandfather, Louis Kelch. Next, of course, was myself. And then following me is my sister, Lovina, spelled L-O-V-I-N-I-A. We always pronounce it Lovina, but I guess it should be Lovinia. I lived in Orem, in this fruit area where they raise a lot of fruit. A lot of strawberries and, of course, a lot of tree fruit, apples and peaches and pears and all kinds of fruit like this. And towards the valley more, they raised a lot of tomatoes. And our home was directly east of the canning factory. So raised in this area of a lot of fresh produce, I always grown to love fresh fruit and fresh vegetables. And I guess that's why I always, no matter where I live, I seem to plant a few fruit trees so that I can still have that fresh fruit that I remember as a child. We moved from Orem when I was just 6 years old. In Orem, I had cousins, my Uncle Albert and Aunt Ethel. Peterson had children there, and I used to play with one we called Bonnie. And then my uncle, Pete Peterson, had children, and we played with Max Peterson, his son, and some of the others. So we kind of grew up around a lot of our cousins. These were on my mother's side. And then on my father's side, there was his brother was Louis Kelch, who was a shoemaker, and he lived in Provo. So we used to go there occasionally, and there I would play with my cousins, Carl and Dees. Carl, which we called Dees, and his brother was just a little older, which was just slightly younger than I was, who was named Roy. We played a lot when we were young. Roy died when he was about 12 years old of infected appendix. So I kind of missed him. We always had a lot of fun together. We'd have periods when we'd always go to Provo. After we moved to Salt Lake, why, it used to be fun. We used to take the old electric urban, we call it, which was electric train that would go from Salt Lake on down to Provo. In fact, it was called the Orem Line, and that's where I got my middle name. This Mr. Orem, who owned the Orem Line, said the first child that was born in Orem would receive a prize. And I happened to be the first child born in Orem. Previous to that, it was called just Provo Bench, which was just part of Utah County. And after it was named a town site, why, then I was the first one born there. My mother said she never got the prize. But we used to like to ride that. There was two electric interurbans or train systems out of Salt Lake. One went south, which was the Orem Line, which I think went as far south as Spanish Fork. The other one was called the Bamberger, which went north to Ogden, and I don't recall whether it went farther north or not. But these were some of the little incidents in my life. We moved to Salt Lake when I was 6, and my first school I attended was Emerson School, and we lived on Yale Avenue and about 10th East. We rented that, and shortly after we moved on, my father bought a home on 8th South and just west of 7th East, and there I went to the Hamilton School. My father worked for a business on State Street, somewhere below 9th South, and This fellow never paid him. So we eventually end up losing that home. In those days, the interest rate was quite high, and I guess not as high as it is today, but much higher than it eventually became through the Depression years. And so we ended up moving down on the west side. And there I went to the Ochre School, which is way down on about 4th North and about 10th West. And I always was a good student and always got A's, mostly A's in all the subjects. And I remember when we were moving from the west side back up the east side, I was getting my coat, and I remember hearing the teacher saying that she was talking to the teacher that taught my brother, and she told her that I was the smartest student that she had ever had. And the other teacher remarked that my brother was a fine student also. That was Randall. We moved up to Doobie Avenue, and here was about just south of 2nd South, between 3rd and 4th East. And here I went to the Ochre School, and this building still standing there, although not being used by a school. On this street was a lot of Jewish people, and I had my first experience among Jewish people at this time, which was to later to continue throughout my life. But they used to, by being the only Gentile on the street, according to them anyway, they used to always have me light their fires on Friday night and Saturday morning, and I'd fill a coal bucket and get kindling and things for them, because the old Jewish Orthodox way is that no one was allowed to do any work from the time of during the Sabbath. The Sabbath started about sunset on Friday and continued through to sunset on Saturday. Most of my youth was spent and kind of having a good time playing. We used to always like to play ball, and there was always a lot of empty fields around that we could set up some diamonds and we'd play. One of our favorite baseball games, we always played hardball, by the way, was rounders, and we just, when there wasn't enough of us, we could just keep playing, and being called rounder, we'd take our turn every time we were out. Why, then we'd shift from right field to center field and left field, and then over third base and second, first, and pitch and catch, and then to bat again. This is always kind of fun to do this, and when we got enough of us around, why, then we'd choose upside and we'd form a team and play the traditional baseball as it's played today. But we always had a lot of fun doing this, and I used to like to play marbles. I remember I won the marble championship when I went to Ochre School. And during the summer months, I was in the swimming team at Central Park, which is a little park there on 2nd South between 2nd and 3rd East. And our team won second place in the city on the relays. And then that same year, I won first place in the and horseshoe pitching. So we just had a lot of fun as kids. I was kind of with my brother most of the time until he was about 14, started going with girls. But we were kind of inseparable when we were young. We would always be together. In fact, my mother at night when it was time for our evening meal would just call my brother's name, Randall, and that meant both of us. So we'd both come because we were always together. I never developed any friends because I always had my brother was always my friend until he started going with girls. And of course, at this time, then I started looking, and one of my first friends was Jack Borg, who still lives in Salt Lake. I see him occasionally once in a while, but we kind of enjoyed our friendship up into high school. And during high school, I developed one other friend, Frank Murray. And we kind of were friends through our junior year in high school. My first year I went to West High. And then Frank Murray, who I developed friendship with during that summer months, moved towards South High, which was a brand new school, and wanted me to go to school there with him. So I decided to go down. It was quite a ways, and I'd ride my bike down. We lived at that time on very near the corner of on 5th East, very near 1st South, in a big red two-story home, which is still there. And I used to ride my bike to school, rain, snow, sleet, no matter what. I never took the bus once. And at the time I was working at Dayton Drugstore on 2nd South and State. So every other night I worked after school, and so I'd have to jump on my bike. As soon as the last class was over, which was 3:20, I'd run down, throw my things in the locker, run down, jump on my bike, pedal up to 5th East, and then head on 5th East to 1st South. And my mother would have some lunch ready for me, some dinner. And so I'd gobble that down and head down and be to work at 2nd South and State by 4 p.m. I don't know how I did this, but I did this every other day while I was working there. And I couldn't afford to eat there, because if I ate there, I only made $40 a month. I wouldn't have any check left, because what it was, I'd charge the hair oil, which we used in those days to keep your hair padded down, and by the time I'd buy my own toothpaste, and I'd buy a soft drink or a malt of milk at the fountain, why, it seems like half my check was gone just for those things. And if I ate there too, I'd end up owing the drugstore. This was during the Depression that I worked there, and it wasn't the most exciting job during the winter months, especially. It was very bad. I'd have to get on my bike, which in those days was I rode what they call a non-coaster, which was a bike without any brakes. All it had is toe clips, and these leather straps would go up over the pedals. So you'd push down on one pedal and pull up on this toe clip with the other foot. And after you got quite adept at it, well, you could put the bike into a skid just like a brake. But it had the narrow tires like the race 7-speed racers are today. But I could really travel on that bike. And when I'd head up 5th East there along by Liberty Park, heading from school to home, I remember I used to pass cars. I'd get that bike going so fast. But one time I was heading on a delivery down 2nd South there, spot by Central Park, and some fellow hit me from behind, and I got lodged under the car, and when I came to, I was lying on my bike, and he kept dragging me. He wouldn't stop, so I started screaming, and I guess I heard some woman scream on the street, so he got frightened, stopped. He'd been drinking, and so when they pulled me out from under the car, both my legs were kind of cut up from the sharp ice. It was during February, and while everybody's paying attention to me, to take me to the emergency hospital, he got in his car and drove away, and they never found him. And I guess the police weren't very efficient in those days. They had enough evidence. They had a broken headlight that said Ford on it, so it must have been a Model A, which was mostly driven in those days. So I don't think they tried very hard to find him. And I was laid up for a couple of weeks in bed, and then I finally got up on crutches and got around. But this one cut was quite deep in my legs. It took about 3 months to heal, but I wasn't so bad, because I got compensation for it. And at that time I was making only $3 a week. This $40 a month, which I spoke of earlier, came later on. So I got $3 a week from the unemployment compensation, or it was the workman's compensation for injuries. They didn't have unemployment compensation in those days. And so I got exactly the same amount of money as if I worked, so I wasn't too anxious to go back to work. And besides, the doctor wouldn't let me go. He said if I went back and I should get infection again, then the insurance wouldn't cover it anymore. My leg would have to be completely healed. So that took about 3 months. So I kind of just read and kind of enjoyed myself around, walked downtown and back, and see what was going on down at the drugstore. Around this time, between the the summer of ending at South High. From South High, I went back to West High as a postgraduate to take art. And I think I took another class in salesmanship, if I remember. I got interested in art in South High, taking an art class. I started getting interested in lettering. So I took this, signed up for this art class, and I went there for 2 years and learned to be quite proficient at lettering. And although not a great artist, I could get by pretty well. This course is a field that led me into the advertising, which has been the profession all my life. During these periods of working at the drugstore, and I'd go to school twice a week. It was just over in the Beeson building upstairs. The school was run by Fielding K. Smith and Newell Cottrell, and they were both pretty good artists. Fielding K. Smith was the better artist, but he's a commercial artist and did some real fine work. So I kind of enjoyed her. I took live classes, and I learned to letter and just about anything I could grasp. I was grasping at straws, anything to get out of the situation I was in working for the drugstore, because it didn't require any ability, any talent. I'd delivered there for a long time and practically freeze to death. And during the winter months, I remember having to deliver a box of 15-cent aspirin clear across the Jordan River. And Mr. Dayton had the nerve, and the person ordering it had even more nerve, to send someone out on a bicycle in 9 below 0 weather to deliver 15 cents worth of aspirin. It may have solved her headache, but it made me suffer extremely, or much more than she was suffering from her little headache. Because my hands, when I get back, were so numb, it'd take about 15 minutes putting them in cold water to get them out. Because when I drive my bike down to the Jordan River, from there on, the snow plows hadn't been. Even in those days, the snow plows didn't go nearly as often on the streets, and so the automobiles would make ruts in the road. It'd be quite deep, and you'd ride your bike in those ruts. And then if a car would be coming, you couldn't get your bike out. You'd have to jump off and lift it out, let the car go by. When you got to the Jordan River, why, there was no ruts. If it'd been a new snow, so I'd have to push my bike for 2 or 3 blocks further west and then a block north. I'm afraid if I just left it, someone would steal it, so I'd have to push it all the way down there. And then when I'd knock on the little door of a little dinky house, this woman would come and take her aspirin and give me the money, and she could see I couldn't even count the change. My hands were so numb. I'd have big fur-lined gloves on, but that didn't do any good in 9 below 0 weather. And she wouldn't even invite me in to get warm. And at this time, I learned to hate people, especially some people, and I learned to hate my job and to hate everything that drugstore stood for, and the people that have no more sense or more value than to order things like aspirin or ice cream to be delivered out in the middle of winter. And in those days, why, Mr. Dayton, during the Depression, why, you'd deliver anything, no matter how small the price was. But those days were to last too long. I worked there 4 years. Meantime, I was going to art school, so I soon developed enough ability to look for a job. So my brother Jack, were working for Grand Central Market, which was owned by Maurice Warshaw. It was kind of a growing supermarket here in Salt Lake. And I could see their signs were so bad. At that time, they were using Mrs. Stewart's bluing and painting them, and every time it would rain, why, it would all wash off, and so they looked pretty bad. So I went down and applied for a job, and at that time, the general manager was Bill Granger. He asked me if I could letter as good as my brothers, and I told him better, and he says, well, there's a roll of paper. Let's see what you can do. And I says, well, where do I paint it? And he says, on the floor like everyone else. I says, well, where's the paint and brushes? And he says, there they are. So I looked over, and here's some paint bottles open, and the brushes sitting down on the paint. So The brushes were all bent out of shape. But luckily, I had brought my good lettering brushes with me, and so I went out into my car and got them and come back in, roll out the paper, and painted a sign. I can't remember what I put on it, but when I finished, I went over and got him, and he said, "You got that done already?" And I said, "It's been done for a while," I says. So he looked at it and said, "Well, you're hired." So to begin with, I got 40 cents an hour, and I was working about 20 hours a week or so, and then I'd make up for work Saturday in the produce department waiting on customers, which they did in those days. They waited on all of them. There wasn't self-service. This progressed along a little later, and then I got a job working full-time, about $25 a week. And so I thought I was in my glory then, because I'd only been making at the drugstore. The most I ever made there was $60 a month, which is only $14 a week. So now all of a sudden I made $25 a week, and I thought I was about the richest man in the world. The drugstore was very poor paying. I started at $3 a week, got up to $40 a month, and finally $60 a month. Then the Roosevelt was president of the United States, and then they had what's called a New Deal. And they had the NRA, which is National Recovery Act, which required that everybody pays a minimum of $60 a month. And so Mr. Dayton had to raise us from the 40 to 60. Well, later on, about a year or so, the NRA was proved unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. So Mr. Dayton lowered our wages back to $40 a month. And three or four months later, he raised them back up to 60. I guess he wanted to show that he could do it. But he was a miserly old man, but I guess maybe he didn't make very much. I always hated him because he seemed to live in a rich home, and he was one of the directors of Continental Bank. And I guess it wouldn't have been so bad to work for low wages if he had been real considerate and helpful and offered to, teach you a few things or encourage you in your education or whatever. But I remember when I was going to art school, the art school was always the same two nights every week. And because I worked every other night after school, I would miss the two on the opposite week, so I would trade with the other boy. We were drug clerks at that time. I wasn't delivering. We were waiting on the soda fountain and then also in the drugstore. And he came to me one time and told me I couldn't do that anymore. I couldn't do any more switching. So I thought it was real mean of him, because all I was doing was trying to educate myself. He thought I should show interest in the drugstore and that been, but how could I get any interest in that when he never tried to teach us anything or help us in any way. So there was no reason to try to learn that business. You had to be a pharmacist anyway to do that, and that required to go to college, so that part was out. So I always had a kind of resentment towards him for the way he treated us. So I was kind of glad when I gave up that place and got my job at $25 a week. So I thought now I was in my glory, and now with all this, with making this much money, I thought we can get married. And this now will have to take us back a little bit in telling about my courting life. Before going into the next stage of my life, which was the married state, I think I should tell a little bit about my forebears. I mentioned before about my mother's name and her father's mother, which was Jens Peterson and Marie Rasmussen. And his father, my grandfather Peterson's father, was Peter Nielsen, and his father was Niels Lavesen. That's the way it is in Denmark. They just take the first name of the father and add the word son. And that's all. Jens Peterson was Peter Nielsen's son. That's about as far back as I know on my mother's side. On my father, he was born in Germany in the city called Sargument. And that's in the province of Alsace-Lorraine between France and Germany. His father was was Lewis Kelts, and my father's father's name was John Kelts, same as my father, and his father was named Lewis Kelts. My grandfather, John Kelts, was married to Mary Hoot, H-U-T-H, and my grandfather's father being Lewis Kelts, and then his father was Baldassar Kelts, I think it was, and finally goes back to someone called Sigismund von Kelts. So my grandfather was born in Bavaria, in the town of Pirmasens, Bavaria, the southern part of Germany. And I don't know too much about him other than that, according to one record I had, that they many of them had been received special citations for their meritorious work in the preserving of the peace, the establishing of peace in Nuremberg in 1812, I think it was. There was one castle there built by Kelts von Bruck, which was near Erlangen in Germany. But I haven't done too much research. One time I was quite interested in doing some research, but they just couldn't seem to do anything in those days. And since then, the church has done a lot of microfilming, but I have failed to go down and see just what they've been able to uncover in relation to my forebears. But on a further tape, I'll try and gather some of the information together, which I have given to Jana Kay, my daughter, and see if I can put some of that information on tape. I'd like to tell a little bit about now. I ended up where I was working for Grand Central Markets, getting $25 a week. So in the meantime, I had been going with a girl for about 2 years. We were engaged for about 2 years. Her name was Rhoda Draper, and she lived across the street from me when I lived on Fifth East, just south of First South, and she lived right across the street next to the Ambassador Athletic Club. She lived with her mother there, who was Ida Mae Lowry. Her father was Charles Draper, but they were separated, so she just lived with her mother there. I don't recall the first time that I went with her. I think it was to Saul there. We went with a group. They were all her friends. Beth Roberts was one of them, and who had been our friends for many years. And we went out there, and I was kind of self-conscious. I didn't know how to dance, but I did the best I could, and we did the usual things like they did at Saul there in those days. We took the little open train. It had no sides on it. Then you'd go downtown and you'd get this train there. It only cost 10 cents. And it would take you out to Great Salt Lake, to Salt there. And that was kind of fun in those days to take that train out. But I don't remember the other occasions of dating Rhoda, but I think my mother liked her. And when I used to come home from work, I was working at the drugstore then, why Rhoda would be on the porch talking to my mother, so we kind of got to be quite friendly, and her being across the street, why it was easy for her to come over, for me to go over there. So she was always interested in what I was doing, and I'd turned my room into kind of a studio where I did all the practicing of my art and lettering and things, and she was quite interested in that. So she'd come over quite often, so we built up a kind of a close friendship, and we got where we did a lot of things together. We were together almost all the time, all our free time when I wasn't working. And she'd walk down at night to the drugstore and meet me when I'd get off at 10 o'clock at night, and then we'd walk on home. Nights that I was off, we would go to a show, and many times we would go at the store and pick up some things and go home and fix up a meal. Those days we didn't have a lot of money to do things with, but we kind of did the best we could. I'd bought a car, it was a 1931 Ford Cabriolet, they call them then days, which was a convertible and had a rumble seat, and it was two-tone, yellow and black, It was one of the first cars that Ford made other than black. He used to say you can make him any color as long as it's black. And he finally relented, and they come out with this one here. It was kind of a flashy little car. I bought it used, and I paid $270-some for it. And even working at the drugstore, I had saved $95 on those meager wages. And I put that down as a down payment, and so I had this car. So Rhoda and I used to drive around a lot, and we'd take friends in the rumble seat. We had a lot of fun together when we were young. Rhoda was a very pretty girl and very attractive, and so she had a good personality and likable. Of course, all exceptionally good disposition, and I didn't have the greatest disposition. I get angry too easily, but she had a good disposition, so it made it work out real fine. So we had went together for these 2 years, and of course, we'd like to have gotten married earlier, but you couldn't very well get married on $60 a month. And it cost you around $35, $40 a month for an apartment. You wouldn't even have enough left for the food. So we kept postponing marriage until I could get finish my art school, where I hoped then I could make more money, which I did. And so as soon as I got the raise, I think we were married within 2 weeks after that. And we were married by the bishop who lived next door to her. And in those days, you didn't take honeymoons. You were afraid to ask the boss if you could have time off. And I had a lot of signs to get out at Grand Central, and I was the only one there. I was the only one in that department for years. And so no one else there to get them out. So I had to go after the marriage and go down and work till about 10 o'clock at night to finish up the signs. And then I come home, and I think that weekend we did something, but I don't recall what it was. But it wasn't as nice as the young people, you know, today have their ceremony and their honeymoon and so forth, which adds a lot, I think, a lot of nice things to remember. But we got by anyway, and so we moved in. Our first apartment was in the Los Gables, and I had bought a few things, furniture for my studio. I had studio couch and a drafting table and an armchair and so forth. So we bought the bed that I'd been sleeping in at home for my folks. And we just kind of makeshift of a few things. We lived in the Lost Gable for about a year, and then we moved to another apartment farther south on 3rd East. And then about the time a little bit later, I was starting to get a lot of extra work. Besides working at Grand Central, I had salesmen that always come in and want me to fix a sign for them or do this piece of art for them. So I couldn't, of course, do it at work. I had to do it at home. And in a little apartment, there was just no place to keep my drafting table or materials and supplies and everything. So I was kind of anxious to get into a house. So we looked for a house, and we found a little home down on west, on about between 3rd and 4th west on 15th south. A fellow by the name of Vern Strand owned it. He had built it, and then he was going to lose it because he couldn't afford to live in it, so he rented it to make the payments. We lived in that for a while, and I had the full basement there where I could do a lot of signs. So I always supplemented my income by doing a few signs at night. It was in this home that our first child was born, which was Myrna, and she was born there. And later on, we moved into another home just east of 3rd West on Paramount Avenue. And a fellow by the name of Fred Bry owned that, and he was having difficulty, so he moved into a kind of little house in the rear and rented that to us. So we lived there for a while until. We were anxious to get into our own home, and at this time they were starting, the FHA had been developed, and they were looking for people to build. A lot of builders were going into business, and you could do it on a small down payment, but we didn't even have that. So anyway, I heard about a fellow by the name of Clarence Maurer who was doing building up in out of Parties Canyon area there. So I approached him, and he said, well, I'd have to have about $200 and $350 down. I told him I didn't have it. And so he says, well, I'll tell you what I'll do. He says, I'll raise the value of the property. The property then was $350 for the lot. It was 50 feet by 155 deep. So he raised the value of it to $750, and then so that when the bank approved it and FHA approved it, why then I would be paying the payments on the full amount, which was $4,200 for the home. Seems cheap now to even think of getting a home for $4,200. It was quite a struggle in those days to pay. We paid some $35, $37 a month payments by the time you bought your groceries and so forth. He didn't have a lot of money left. I think at that time we bought our home, I was making about $40 a week. I'd received raises. So, but it was nice to get into our new home, to get in as recently as we could. I did a lot of the finish work, finished the floors and painted all the interior and all the exterior, and of course all the yard work. And first thing I did is planted some peach trees in the back. We had raspberries and some boysenberries and that, and it was real fun to have all that fresh fruit during the summer months. Here, my second child was born, which was Ronald Lewis, and he was born in on Preston Street, as well as some of the other children. Jana Kay, which was the next one, was born there. And then the one following her was Joanne, who we called Jody. And, of course, we had a tragedy with her. She just lived till she was 3 years old and then died of leukemia. And this was a kind of a hard experience for Rhoda and I to go through. When you're young, it's hard to understand death and all it entails, especially when you see a young, beautiful little girl, you know, that's only three, pass away. Why, it's kind of a hard experience. And through the years, you kind of get over it, but I guess you really never get over those things. You know, it's kind of hard to lose your parents, but I guess the hardest thing is to lose a child, and I guess probably even worse than that would be to lose your mate. But we got through it all right, and after Jody was born, Franz was born there, and in fact, he was just a baby at the time that Jody died. So about that time, our family was growing, and I built into the basement and built two bedrooms down there and a bath down there, but it still wasn't adequate. I remodeled our kitchen. I tore out the little closets and put in wardrobe closets, but the home was still small, and it was on a 50-foot frontage lot, so it was very difficult to build on. The only way you could build is in the rear, and that wouldn't improve the value of your home very much. So Rhoda and I started looking for another place to live.